Perimeter Institute, and I really like it here. It's a very nice place, so you guys should be proud. So as Luis said, I'll be talking to you about detectable signatures of compact binaries involving neutron stars, and this is work that I've done at the University of Illinois. And at this point, I would just like to just acknowledge my collaborators, Zach Atien, Brian Ferris, Roman Gold, who's here today, Yakdong Liu, and Stuart Shapiro. All these used to be at the University of Illinois at some point. Zach is leaving. Brian is at Columbia University. And Yakdong, who knows? I don't know where he is right now. All right, so a quick look at the outline. I split the talk in two parts. In the first part, I'll talk about white dwarf neutron star binaries. I'll try to argue that they're interesting and that we should be studying these binaries. Then I'll talk about the late evolution of a white dwarf neutron star binary, and basically that has two possible fates. One is to either undergo stable mass transfer in that regime, and then the binary, instead of in-spiraling, actually out-spirals. And the other regime is the unstable mass transfer when you have the white dwarf tidal disruption, and that leads to the merger. Now, in this case, when you have the tidal disruption, you may form a disk, and there's been some recent studies where nuclear reactions have been taken into consideration in these accretion flows, and these actually lead to some interesting effects, and I'll go over these. So in the second part of the talk, I'll focus on black hole neutron star binaries, and in particular on pre-merger electromagnetic signals that may be detectable from such systems. I'll focus on the mechanism that is called the unipolar inductor, and I'll give you some introduction in that. And then I'll talk about general relativistic force free simulations of these systems that we've done in order to see whether this unipolar induction mechanism is a viable mechanism in black hole neutron stars. And then I'll conclude. All right, so why are white dwarf neutron star binaries interesting? First of all, like binary neutron stars, we know that they exist. And this is a table of known pulsars that have a white dwarf companion that we've compiled in a little paper back in 2009. And out of these pulsars with white dwarf companions, there are at least four that have been where the companion has been identified in the optical spectrum to be a white dwarf. So we know that they exist. And moreover, we know that according to population synthesis studies, there are about 2 million white dwarf neutron star binaries in our galaxy, with a merger rate of about 10 to the minus 5 per year. And therefore, LISA-like detectors should be able to detect between 1 to 10 pre-merger events per year. And so they should be detectable. Now, just to get a feeling of the gravitational wave strain, we can just use the quadruple approximation, plug in reasonable values for the mass of the neutron star, 1.5 solar masses, for the mass of the white dwarf, 0.5, typical separations of about 3 white dwarf radii away, then 30,000 kilometers away, and within our galaxy, and we get a strain of about 10 to the minus 21. The frequencies that we expect are of order 10 to the minus 2 with the same parameters, and ELISA's predicted strain sensitivity at this frequency range is of order 10 to the minus 23, so these should be detectable and resolvable, actually, by ELISA. Now, in addition to gravitational waves, white dwarf neutron star mergers can also lead to catastrophic phenomena. So you can get the white dwarf tidal disruption. You may also get a neutron star collapse to a black hole. You may also get nuclear burning or detonations, and that would lead to some other interesting electromagnetic observables. So what does the late evolution of the white dwarf neutron star binary look like? Just like all binaries, we know that gravitational waves are going to be emitted. Therefore, the separation is going to be decreasing as a function of time. Here, in this illustration, I have the neutron star on the left, the white dwarf on the right. This dashed yellow line are the Roche lobes of each object here. Now, in case you don't know what a Roche lobe is, it's essentially the sphere of influence, of gravitational influence of the star. Anything that lies within the Roche lobe of the white dwarf belongs gravitationally to the white dwarf. Anything that's outside does not belong to the white dwarf. Yeah, it's just an illustration here. You're right. Yeah, it's just illustrative here. So what happens is that if there's matter that lies outside here, it does not belong to the white dwarf. And so what we know is that the Roche lobe radius, there are very known fitting formulae in the literature, is proportional to the rate to the separation of the binary times a function of the mass ratio, which for low mass ratios is actually given by this formula here. And the mass ratio is defined as the mass of the white dwarf to that of the neutron star. So the separation goes down due to the gravitational waves. If A goes down, the Roche lobe radius goes down. Therefore, it shrinks. So you can imagine that there is a critical separation between the two binaries where the white dwarf actually feels its Roche lobe. And at this point, the white dwarf matter is actually prone to leaving the white dwarf through this inner Lagrangian point and going to the vicinity of the neutron star, essentially. And so if we assume now that we do have, we just take some small parcel of matter and we carry it over to the neutron star area, this is the total orbital angular momentum. And if we neglect the spin angular momentum of the stars, which are very, very small at these separations, then angular momentum conservation means that the separation must scale like the product of the two masses to the minus second power, just from this formula. Now, if you combine that with the mass conservation, if you say that m dot of the neutron star is minus m dot of the white dwarf, then you can derive the evolution of a dot over a in the second formula. And now this is a very interesting consequence. The quantity in the parenthesis is negative. The mass of the white dwarf is smaller than the mass of the neutron star. M dot is negative because the white dwarf is losing mass. Therefore, this right-hand side is a positive quantity, which means that a actually increases with time. Now, A increases with time. This means that the Roche lobe radius increases with time. So you should shut down the mass transfer from the white dwarf. However, the white dwarf has a very interesting mass radius relationship due to its equation of state. If the mass of the white dwarf goes down, its radius increases. So now we run into these two competing effects. The white dwarf wants to grow. The Roche lobe also wants to grow. And so whether you're going to run into some runaway instability or not will depend on what grows faster. And this is exactly what this relationship is telling us. If the time scale for the growth of the white dwarf is greater than the time scale for the growth of the Roche lobe, then you have stability. And so now you can use this equation, this A dot, the Roche lobe radius equation, and the mass radius relationship, plug them into this equation, and you arrive. I agree, yes. In principle, you can have that. This is a very crude picture just to get the feeling, the first understanding, you know, the zeroth order understanding of how the stable mass transfer regime, you know, works. You're right, there are other effects. There are also other effects that have to do with the fact that I'm considering essentially point mass neutron star. You may have spin up of the neutron star, and therefore you can actually get rid of angular momentum onto spinning up the neutron star instead of just feeding it back to the orbit. So this whole theory assumes that you take angular momentum from the white dwarf, which is spinning, essentially, and you feed it back into the orbital angular momentum, and that's why the separation increases. That's what happens. All right, so, and if you do all that, you find that there's a critical mass ratio. It's of order 2/3. Such that if the mass ratio of the binary is greater than the critical mass ratio, you get unstable mass transfer. You have this runaway. The white dwarf really overfills its Roche lobe, and you get tidal disruption. If you have a mass ratio less than this critical mass ratio, you arrive at this stable mass transfer regime. So first, I'll talk about briefly about this crude calculations we did for the stable mass transfer, and then I'll go to the unstable mass transfer. But before I do that, what are the expected gravitational wave frequencies at this Roche separation? It's not very just tough to see that if you just go to these known binaries for which we know the masses and the mass ratios. From the mass ratio, you can actually determine the Roche lobe radius. And if you set the Roche lobe radius equal to the white dwarf radius, given that we know the white dwarf radius from the mass radius relationship, we can find the radius of the white dwarf. So setting the radius of the white dwarf equal to the Roche lobe radius will give immediately the separation, the Roche separation. And assuming a Keplerian frequency, which is to 1% and exact the actual frequency for these binaries, then you can actually determine what is the gravitational wave frequency that you expect. And for these observed binaries turns out to be of order 10 to the minus 2 hertz. And this is fortunate because if you just look at the noise gear for Lisa, and this is the noise gear for Elisa, here, this board's right exactly at the sweet spot where these objects should be detected in. No, it's 2. Oh, no, no, but this is the equivalent strain. It's per hertz, square root hertz. It's not the actual. That was for the strain, not the per hertz strain, right? So these are the usual noise curves that they show for LIGO and LISA. That's the difference. Right. Yeah, it's exactly right. That's the point.
No, but also if each cutting post makes that curve go a little bit higher, then it's gone.
I think no.
Match filtering.
Well, excuse me.
Then with match filtering techniques, you can get it
done. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And I mean, probably the better number to put is you want to tell us what the sigma of the noise for detection of
Well, I haven't done the actual calculation, but I've seen, okay. So the actual studies that have been performed for these systems are only when Lisa was around, where people think that Lisa was going to be around. So based on Lisa, these systems are detectable based on signal-to-noise ratios of order 10, essentially. But I haven't seen yet an analysis that holds for the ELISA, for the new gravitational observatory. I presume that it should be forthcoming. Probably Nelemens or some of these guys who work on these topics, they should do
it. Well, now the hope is that the full list that we brought up will know in a few months.
I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, there is a new
hope.
NASA might get in. And if NASA gets in, they will recover the initial operation.
Well,
okay,
we can talk about that.
Yeah. All right, so how can we just understand, you know, crudely, at least initially, the evolution in the stable mass transfer regime? We can adopt the approach of Clark and Eardley. It was done for neutron star binaries, and later on was adopted by Faber et al. For black hole neutron star binaries. And that's essentially the conservative mass transfer regime, as you talked about, where we assume that the only drain of angular momentum is essentially gravitational waves, and then assuming the quadrupole approximation for JGW, which at these separations, it's an excellent approximation. And co-rotation for the white dwarf, which can be questioned, of course. It's questionable. You can derive a simple system of uncoupled ordinary differential equations for the evolution of the mass and the orbital separation. And that you can solve numerically very easily. I'm just showing here the equation for the mass just as an illustration. And the only thing I just want to draw your attention is the only thing it depends on is the initial mass ratio and the initial mass of the white dwarf. Anything else is determined automatically by the mass radius relationship and the location of the Roche lobe separation, essentially. And everything falls together, you just integrate it. So, and just as an illustration for some numerical integrations, I'm just showing three binaries here that we've evolved with increasing mass ratio. So this is the order of increasing mass ratio. The larger the mass ratio, the faster the binary evolves. So these are the timescales for the white dwarf to lose about half of its mass, ranges between tens of thousands of years to millions of years, depending on what the initial mass is. And then the separation divided by the Roche lobe separation as a function of time. This is just assuming the quadrupole approximation for the end spiral, and then going into the stable mass transfer regime, you see that this effect that we talked about, the separation increases. And then a question would be, what would the expected gravitational wave signature would look like, at least on a qualitative basis, then you can use the quadrupole approximation, assuming the orbital frequency remains Keplerian, and the characteristics for the orbital separation that we found from the numerical integration, and the mass for the white dwarf and the neutron star. And then you can just plug it in, and you can find this is the envelope, this is the plus polarization, the cross polarization here. This is the envelope of a gravitational wave, and this is the inset focus on an interval of 120 seconds at the beginning and about 600 years later. And this is just to show that both the amplitude and the frequency decrease with time. So it's the inverse of a chirp signal, essentially. That's what you get here. Yeah.
In the systems that people know, and we know in operation, we have subsystems that fall in either of the two classes.
Yes, yes.
Is there anything that we can go after to try to see if there's any smoking gun when pointing to the two behaviors that one can fix and it's not even tested? Time scales are very long.
Well, I mean, just the mass ratios themselves will tell you whether you're going to fall in one regime or the other. So that's the best bet you can only bet. Now, to see whether you're going to have a tidal disruption or a stable mass transfer, first of all, I should say that stable mass transfer is observed in the universe. We observe binaries that demonstrate this behavior. And we see that the separation is actually increasing based on electromagnetic signatures. So we know that stable mass transfer is a regime that occurs in nature. But we've never observed a white dwarf neutron star binary in that regime yet. So we've only observed it for accretion onto a neutron star with a main sequence star. These are the cases that we've seen these guys. But yeah, we would have to be quite fortunate, I guess, to capture one in this regime and say that it's stable mass transfer. Oh, it's... But I didn't say we've seen unstable mass transfer for the main sequence star. I'm not aware of a case where we've seen unstable mass transfer with a main sequence star. It's a good point. I That's right. It goes onto the neutron star. We're talking about direct impact accretion, essentially. This is the... Yes, in this calculation, no. But we have some other calculations where we actually account for the formation of a disk. And you take that into consideration. But there's no single calculation that we've done that accounts for a spin-up of the neutron star. We don't take consideration into gravitational wave emission from the disk, but we take into the consideration angular momentum being imparted essentially in the disk and on a disk profile around the neutron star instead of having a direct impact accretion that would feed back directly the angular momentum into the orbit instead. Yes, but it's the amount of matter is small, so you would have.
Right, but that changing amount of matter is definitely the decrease here, right?
This is mainly, the decrease actually is mainly coming from the outspiraling motion. That's why. It's not so much the changing in the mass. We have to remember that it moves outward. Yeah. But I'm sure that all of these effects, if you eventually take them into consideration, they will make a difference. This is just a qualitative picture. I'm not saying it's a correct picture. So, and here are my caveats. So, of course, so far we've assumed conservative mass transfer. That's one thing. And co-rotation, which is also another thing that you can question. The white dwarf doesn't necessarily need to co-rotate. You can actually have some out-of-phase sync of the... out of sync rotation of the white dwarf. Also, the neutron star is not a point mass. Accretion is, and it's not going to be tidally locked. Accretion will transfer angular momentum to the neutron star. This will change the actual signature. Allowing for a neutron star spin up will change, therefore, the waveforms of the stable mass transfer regime. And in fact, the stable mass transfer is such a dirty world. It's like, it's not a solved problem in astrophysics. There are many unknown parameters. And I think my take is that eventually, it's gravitational wave measurements that are going to tell us what the actual correct physics is behind that. So if we're able to detect a binary that is in that regime, then we'll be able to constrain the physics that goes into the stable mass transfer. But this is a qualitative picture.
Quick question.
Yeah.
If you have a main sequence star, then the time scale for tidal locating about 1,000 years or so.
because if you look at the actual viscosities that are required in order to tidally lock the white dwarf, they turn out, if you consider just standard molecular viscosity, it turns out that it fails by many orders of magnitude. There's no way you're going to be able to tidally lock the white dwarf. Now, if you require tidal locking of the white dwarf, there's a very interesting work that has been done by, forgot his name, he's at the University of Illinois, Ron Webbing, where he showed that if you enforce the tidal locking onto the white dwarf, the shearing that is going to be imposed onto the white dwarf and the release of heat due to this shearing is going to result essentially in lifting the degeneracy of the white dwarf. And you would actually have a white dwarf that is very, very bright. We've never actually observed something like that. And so whether tidal locking takes place for a white dwarf or not is still a topic under discussion. You know, it's not a resolved issue. So it's... Okay, that's interesting. I haven't seen the paper, so. Right, so now let's go to the unstable mass transfer regime. And so what are some plausible outcomes that we might expect? If the total mass of the white dwarf neutron star remnant exceeds the neutron star maximum mass, then you might expect that you'll get from collapse of black hole. If you form a disk around this black hole, you might form some kind of analog to the gamma ray burst. Now, this has a very interesting gravitational wave signature because it will possibly sweep both the ELISA and the LIGO bands. The ELISA from the in-spiral and the LIGO from the gravitational wave burst that you get from the collapse of the neutron star, if indeed this happens. So that would be quite interesting. Now, you may also get a formation of a differentially rotating hypermassive neutron star. If you don't know what a hypermassive neutron star is, a neutron star that is differentially rotating and it can support a mass more than the maximum allowed mass if you allow for maximum uniform rotation. And that will essentially lead to delayed collapse of a black hole, if that's the case. Or you may form something that we call the Thorne-Zitko-like object. If you've never heard what a Thorne-Zitko object is, it's a neutron star and a main sequence star, or a red giant, actually. And the neutron star essentially, once the in-spiral takes place, slowly, gradually, in spirals toward the center of the red giant, stays there, accretes matter, it goes over the maximum mass limit, it collapses to a black hole, and then the star is essentially an accretion-powered star from that point on. So this was an idea put forth by Thorne and Zitko in the 70s, and so we think that it's plausible that you might actually form something like that from neutron star white dwarf binaries. And you might actually get an ejection of appreciable white dwarf debris that will leave back a rotating neutron star remnant. And if that debris has some radioactive heavy elements, you may get some interesting electromagnetic signatures. You may get a disk and a neutron star. And this is an interesting scenario. If the disk lives long enough and it fragments, it may actually lead to a plausible channel for planet formation around neutron stars. This is a long-standing problem in astrophysics, how to form planets around neutron stars. The first planets we ever detected were actually around a pulsar, and so we don't yet really know what is the way to form planets around the neutron star. So to identify any of these scenarios, of course, hydrodynamic simulations are required, and full general relativity is needed to determine reliably whether the neutron star collapses to a black hole or not. So can we do the simulations? And if not, what's the reason behind that? So what is the computational challenge that we have to deal with? This we can actually get a glimpse for if we look at the length scales and the time scales involved in the problem. So for a white dwarf of about a solar mass, the radius is about 5,000 kilometers. For a neutron star of 1.5 solar mass, the radius is about 10 kilometers. So we have about 500 is the ratio between the two. The separation at the Roche lobe limit is about 2 to 5 white dwarf radii. And if we wanted to calculate gravitational waves, then we'd have to be at least 2 times away. And that would give us about 5,000 times the neutron star radius. So we have about 3 or 4 orders of magnitude in length scale spanning the neutron star radii. Sorry, in the length scale span about 3 orders of magnitude in neutron star radii. And this is not the main problem. You can use adaptive mesh refinement, and you can deal with the length scales. What's killing the problem are the time scales. If you want to see whether the neutron star is going to collapse, you have to resolve the neutron star. So you have to resolve the dynamical time scale of the neutron star. That turns out to be about 5m. The Weidorf dynamical time scale is about 10 to the 5m. And the orbital period, which is the time scale over which the merger takes place, is about 10 to 6m at the Roche loop separation. So we're talking about six orders of magnitude in m. And this makes the problem really, really difficult to track. So back in the day when we were working on that, Ranger was still around. We used just a benchmark run just to see what the brute force calculation would require. And we used 256 cores. These simulations actually require very large resolutions if you want to maintain, preserve angular momentum in the system, at least with our code. And we, based on these benchmark runs, we can compute that it would take about 132 years just to do five orbits for the system. You want to reduce it to three orbits, just divide this by 3/5. Or computers today are a little faster, maybe by a factor of 4. Well, I think a decade still is not really a reasonable number to do the simulations. So at least we can conclude that full GR hydro simulations at present are not really practical. So can we do anything about it? And the idea that we used was the pseudo-white dwarf idea. So what is a pseudo-white dwarf? A pseudo-white dwarf is an object that has the same mass as a white dwarf, but is smaller in size. So we keep the masses of the object exactly the same, but we reduce the size of the white dwarf, and essentially we reduce the length, the range of length scales and time scales involved in the problem, trying to make the computational challenge smaller. So how do we construct these objects? We choose a piecewise polytropic equation of state, such as shown here. And we make sure that when we construct the mass versus central density for the object curve, we make sure that we maintain the number of stable branches and unstable branches and the turning points in this equation of state on this plot. So this solid curve here is the realistic data for a white dwarf equation of state. This dotted curve here, probably you cannot see it, is the realistic equation of state for a neutron star that corresponds to the AP2 version of the Ackermann-Ravenhall-Pandari-Pond equation of state. And so this dash curve is a fit that we used for these two equations of state, realistic equations of state, with this parametric form, essentially. So we can actually capture that. And so this is the actual stable white dwarf branch, and this is the stable neutron star branch. We have unstable white dwarfs here and unstable neutron stars. And so what we did then is we pushed with this equation of state, making sure we preserve the shape of this curve to higher densities, such that essentially if we have the same mass and a higher density, this means the object is smaller. And this is the branch of what we call the pseudo-white dwarf, essentially. But at the same time, we make sure that our equation of state does not change the neutron star branch. And so this is how we construct these pseudo-white dwarfs. And then the project becomes possible. Now, is there any justification behind this pseudo-white dwarf approach? And the answer is yes. To zeroth order, it's scalability. So the reason is the following. The pre-shot white dwarf sound speed scales just like the mass over the radius of the white dwarf to the 1/2 power. The same is true about the collision velocity. If you just let these two guys collide, it will scale like the white dwarf to the 1/2 power. Therefore, the Mach number, which is V over C, is invariant under the white dwarf radius. This tells us how much shock heating will become important if you change the size of the object, keeping the masses fixed. This is the important thing, that we keep the masses fixed. The thermal energy, the kinetic energy, and the gravitational potential energy all scale as the mass squared divided by the white dwarf radius. And therefore, the relative importance of the thermal energy and the kinetic energy with respect to the gravitational potential energy when you change the radius is also invariant under the white dwarf radius. And so pseudo-white dwarf mergers are scalable to white dwarf neutron star mergers, provided that you keep the masses fixed. So that's the, of course, there are more details that come into play if you want to go to higher order effects. Yes? No. This is a general thing. There will definitely be corrections due to the changing the structure of the star, just because you're changing the equation of state, essentially. But to first, to zeroth order, I would say, I'm not going to say first order, this argument is true. If you just write down, you know, how these quantities scale with the masses and the radii, you'll have some factor that accounts for the structure of the star times m squared over r, for example. Yes, so I'm gonna talk about that. So we wanted to test the scalability using, well, and this is not the way it turned out to be, but we performed first, before we did the actual merger simulations, we performed head-on collisions, and then I looked back and I tried to see whether it makes any sense. Do the results scale? So we did first head-on collision between a white dwarf and a neutron star, modeling the stars assuming a perfect fluid surface energy tensor, then assume the stars to be temporally at rest at a large separation and a moment of time symmetry. This means that the extrinsic curvature is zero. We assume Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff profiles for the stars. We solve the Hamiltonian constraints using a finite fixed mesh refinement finite difference code that we developed. And the momentum is constraint is trivially satisfied. If you don't know what all this jargon means, this is just valid general relativistic initial data. And the cases we looked at are the following. Changing the equation of state, we fixed the neutron star mass and the white dwarf mass to be 0.98, the neutron star mass 1.5. This is a mass of the neutron star versus ratio of the white dwarf radius to the neutron star radius. And that goes from 5 to 10 to 20. And we did these three simulations and tried to see whether results scale. So to do the evolution, we employ the Illinois GR Hydrodynamics AMR code. The equation of state has a thermal component and a cold component. The cold component is the piecewise polytropic equation of state I showed you. The thermal component is standard. This is very standard in our field, at least. And this gamma thermal is chosen to be 1.66, which is appropriate for degenerate electrons, non-relativistic, or hot non-degenerate baryons. Excuse me? It's cactus. Yeah. So these are the results of these head-on collisions. We find in all cases the same outcome, no collapse of black hole. The 14% to 18% of the mass ejected is ejected to infinity, in all cases settled a Thorne-Zitko-like object. The final total mass is greater than the maximum mass, and we expect delayed collapse. Now, the fact that all three cases yield the same ejected mass at the at infinity, it's good indication, essentially, that the results do indeed scale. We find that if you look at the temperature, for example, it doesn't scale perfectly. It does scale with the white dwarf radius. We do find the trend that the larger the smaller the compaction, the temperature turns out to be a little it doesn't follow the actual two factor that you would expect. It goes like 1.5 instead of a factor of two, because with the ratio between the two in the three cases is actually exactly two. But I think that our results suggest that it's a good indication, at least, that this scalability that we're talking about is indeed happening. Now, to be honest, if you look at the 5-to-1 case, that's the case that leads to the 14% outcome, and it doesn't lead 18% of the initial total mass mass ejected to infinity. So the 5-to-1 case is a case that I think is not very safe to include. I think it's too compact to use that. So from probably the 10-to-1 and the 10-to-20-to-1 cases are more more into the regime where this scalability starts to kick in. So I think it's a good reasonable approximation as a zeroth order. So the question then is, what about the circular merger? So for the circular merger, we adopted the same assumptions as for the head-on collision. But in addition, we have a binary pseudo-white dwarf neutron star with initial data in circular orbit this time that are co-rotational, quasi-equilibrium, and satisfy the conformal thin sandwich equations. And again, this means valid general relativistic initial data. Yeah, you. it's a version of the Hamiltonian and the momentum constraint. Let's just put it this way. So if you're aware of what the Hamiltonian momentum constraints are, it's a formulation that combines the GR equations to to solve an initial binary such that it is in a quasi-equilibrium, essentially. That's the basic idea behind it. All right, so the case, one case, was only one simulation. Even though it didn't take 132 years, it took 9 months to complete due to very high resolutions. So the neutral solar mass was 1.4 solar masses. The white dwarf mass was 1 solar mass. The ratio between the radii is the 10 to 1, not the 20 to 1 case. That would take even longer to compute. And the mass ratio, therefore, is 0.7, which is greater than 0.66. So you expect that you would get a white dwarf dipole disruption in this case. It's in the unstable mass transfer branch. The total mass is 2.4. The maximum mass allowing for maximal rotation is 2.1. So the question we wanted to address, is the remnant going to collapse and form a black hole? The evolution techniques are the same as in the Hedon case. And here I'm supposed to show you a movie. So this is the simulation that took 9 months. So this little guy is the neutron star. This is the pseudo white dwarf. And this is a equatorial density contours of the system. So soon after the first orbit is completed, an accretion stream forms. And about 2.5 orbits following the evolution, the white dwarf is tidally disrupted, and they merge, and a very large disk around the neutron star forms, and we don't get any collapse of a black hole. Mm-hmm. That's right, yes, yes. So it has to do with the initial data, and I can get into details if you want. No, it's an artifact of our initial data not being in perfect quasi-equilibrium.
Okay, so what I mean is the white dwarf on your grid really pulsating, or is it a coordinate effect?
Oh, no, it is pulsating, it is. Because you can actually see it in quantities like the value of the central central density, Resmus density, so. Yes. Well, what I noticed was in our simulations, I didn't do a careful analysis, but I noticed there was a clump of matter around the neutron star that was actually moving, rotating there. Eventually, it settled, and the spiral density waves here in this simulation actually are not stopping. But I'll show you a later simulation where we actually have included cooling, and that settles eventually, and there's no M equals one mode or something.
So that pump's about 2 or 3 orders of magnitude more dense than the stuff around it. I thought it looked kind of red.
Yes, yes, it's this red part, yes. That's right. Yeah, yep, that's right, it is. We didn't compute any gravitational waves because the gravitational waves don't scale. So we were just interested in the hydrodynamics part here. If I were to show the gravitational waves, it would be a very, very strong signal at a frequency which is very, very high, not very representative of the system. But yeah, maybe you could argue, I don't know, maybe that qualitative would look like that, and maybe you can just decrease the frequency and then decrease the amplitude at the same time and somehow recover the actual gravitational wave form. But yeah. All right. Okay, so so we find that there's no prone collapse of black hole, and the remnant is a very hot remnant, and it's differentially rotating, and it has an extended disk around it. So the next question we wanted to address was, is this thermally or centrifugally supported? And so to address the question, we introduced parametric optically thin covariant cooling, which is it's optically thin. It's a good assumption that it's optically thin because the material, the white dwarf material, which is the shock heated material, is going to be optically thin to neutrinos, and it's going to be the dominant emission mechanism in that regime. So that's not the bad thing. Eventually, what we wanted is just remove all the excess heat and see whether this object is going to collapse. That's the basic idea. So we choose the cooling timescale to be much longer than the dynamical timescale to mimic a adiabatic cooling, essentially, a very slow cooling mechanism, and evolve with and without cooling and see whether there are any differences. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't try to do that, no. But I'll show you, I have something that kind of looks like that. And then you'll get an idea of the compaction, yes. It's all the mass, there's nothing ejected to infinity, so it's the entire object. So this is the simulation with cooling. So we took the Riemann as it was there, and then just starting it to cool it. And as you can see, just based on what you just said, it doesn't get much more compact, basically. It's pretty much staying the same, and it doesn't collapse. Oh, this, no, because it doesn't make any difference to run it before the merger. Shock heating starts to occur after merger. Yes, that's right. So it's heating the material. We let the shock heating take place, and then we start to cool. That's the idea behind it. So if you were to cool at the same time where shock heating was taking place, this cooling time was much longer, and it wouldn't make such a huge difference. It would make a small difference, but not as big of a difference. So here I'm going to get to what you just, well, not here, probably the next one. I think I skipped let me skip the slide, actually. So to see what's going on, we plotted the value of the maximum Rasmus density in the remnant as a function of time. Normalized by the value it had at the time we actually turned cooling on, and see if you don't cool it, we evolved the simulations that say for about 10 cooling time scales, and we didn't see any effect. So initially it increases, but then it starts to level off. You might say that if I let it evolve, it's going to continue to increase, but now getting to what you asked, if you plot the mass in the remnant contained within 40 kilometers from the center of mass of the remnant, then it starts to level off, and it's not even near the maximum mass within 40 kilometers that you would expect. So we don't expect this thing to collapse at all in this simulation. So these outer layers are going to probably coming a little closer and maybe get more mass here, but this seems to be leveling off into this configuration. Oh, it was just a random thing. I didn't. That's right. So the thing is that, well, the total mass is 2.4 solar masses. So if a black hole were to form, it would be much smaller than that, right? So the reason why I chose 40 kilometers was basically that the initial neutron star, the maximum mass configuration for a neutron star, which is the one that leads to collapse, has a size of order 15 kilometers. So if there's no way, if I cannot put within 15 kilometers the maximum mass that can be supported, then this thing is not going to collapse. So that's the idea. So here I'm having 40 kilometers, and it's 1.6 solar masses. And in order for it to collapse, if we were not rotating, or even if it were rotating, I would need to put about 2 solar masses within 20 kilometers.
Well, I mean, it depends what the process is. You can put a very tiny amount of mass in a sufficiently small region that comes back or the tiny black hole, and from there it goes.
Yeah, but the density of the neutron star has to reach the maximum mass, near the maximum mass density that is that it can be supported by the, this is not even close to the maximum mass central density that is required for a non-spinning neutron star. So it's quite far, actually. It's not, it doesn't look like it's going to collapse. Yes, yes.
What is the conclusion that you're drawing here? You don't follow a black hole, or is it,
Sorry, I'm.
But I mean, is that because of, you're missing viscosity of this, all this eventually will collapse.
I'm getting there. Don't worry. Yeah. So the results of our simulation seem to indicate that for a binary of a neutron star that has a neutron star with 1.4 solar masses and a white one solar mass, we found that there's no prone collapse of a black hole. That if a differentially rotating hot remnant forms that resembles a Thorne-Zietkow object near the center. And then it's surrounded by a very massive disk. And we conclude that it's centrifugally supported because it doesn't collapse following cooling. So of course, the question is, we have more mass than our equation of state can support. So can you get delayed collapse due to a mechanism that redistributes angular momentum? Of course, in that case, this is possible, and you're right. And maybe the magnetorotational instability can actually do that for us. Now, the most important question that we thought about addressing, actually, was we have a white dwarf that has carbon, has oxygen. Could it be that this whole picture is actually cannot even never be realized because nuclear reactions kick in, and then they actually start to disrupt things, and we never actually form a black hole anyways? So you can actually do a very quick back-of-the-envelope calculation about the temperatures you expect. So if you take the thermal energy, which is in the white dwarf envelope around the neutron star, because the neutron star is cold, and equate it to the available gravitational binding energy that is released during the merger process, then you can actually get a very nice expression for the temperature. And it turns out to be about 10 to the 9 Kelvin for a realistic white dwarf of compaction 10 to the minus 4 and this mass ratio of 0.7 that we are dealing with. Now, typical white dwarf densities are 10 to the 6. And if you pick and choose your favorite nuclear astrophysics book, and you'll see that at these temperatures and these densities, carbon is actually ignited. And you can actually start to fuse carbon, but probably not oxygen. Yeah, they are. Yeah, we've looked at the remnant. Now, if you can believe the scaling and scale it back to the realistic cases, the remnant, when we looked at the distribution of temperature, it was larger. It was like this. So this would be the neutron star. So the peak temperatures were actually near on top of the neutron star, and then it was going down. And the typical temperature was in our simulations was actually 10 to the 11 because of the compaction that comes into the game. Whereas in this case, it should be actually 10 to the 9. All right, so. No, no, we didn't. But the resolution we use was dictated based on convergence of the conservation of angular momentum. So we started with low resolutions, and we saw that there was a lot of angular momentum lost. So I can tell you that the code converges up until maybe the first orbit, if I recall well, for the convergence study that we did. Because after the first orbit is completed with low resolutions, the binary merges. And because we don't really conserve after that point angular momentum, so it's quite spurious after that point. So this was the highest resolution that we tried that gave a successful binary evolution. And it was very expensive. All right, so recently, Metzger in 2011 and Fernandez and Metzger in 2012, they considered Newtonian accretion flows that include nuclear burning. They envisioned these accretion flows as being formed from a tidal disruption of a white dwarf that has a mass less than 0.6 solar masses and forming around the neutron star. So what they did was 1D height integrated nuclear reaction, including nuclear reaction networks, and then 2D simulations that are axis metric, including a parametric nuclear burning, and focusing mainly on carbon burning. And they assumed the Shakura-Sanai of alpha parameterization for the viscosity that drives the accretion onto the neutron star. So they termed this new accretion flow as nuclear-dominated accretion flow, because it turns out that in some regimes, the nuclear reactions become dynamically the most important factor. And so for these flows, they use this term. And so they also find that there can be detonation or quiescent burning based on this ratio here, this dimensionless ratio, which is the energy released, the nuclear energy released per unit mass to the specific enthalpy. Total specific enthalpy. And so it turns out, according to their calculations, that if this ratio is greater than 1, then you get detonation, and the disk eventually becomes unbound. And this is the movie of this. So burning, they find that burning actually starts at the innermost disk, because that's where you have the higher temperatures and densities. And then eventually, propagates to the outer layers, and then here they have some outflows first, and then detonation takes place, and boom. All right. So in the quiescent phase, when this ratio is less than one, they find that there's steady outflow of ash from the polar axis, and the yeah, I'll get to that. So the steady state quiescent burning they consider was the picture that Metzger actually thought about was the following: that you have essentially as you move to the toward the central object that you have higher densities and higher temperatures, so you'll be burning to heavier and heavier elements, just like it occurs in red giants or old stars, and eventually that you'll reach a point where the temperature densities are so high that you photo disintegrate the heavy nuclei, and eventually, if you go even further, then the disk becomes neutrino cooling dominated because it's very important around the neutron star surface. So what they found from the 1D simulations is that the ejecta may contain all these heavy elements that I list here. Most importantly, 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 2 solar masses of radioactive nickel 56. And this is what powers type 1A supernovae, in case you didn't know. And so it was argued in that paper that this recently discovered subluminous type 1 supernovae explosion may be accounted for by white dwarf neutron star mergers. All right, so that's the end of the first part. I'm going to try to go quickly. Is there a clock here? 5 minutes. Ooh. Okay, too many. All right, you can stop me. If you know what a unipolar inductor is, I can actually go directly to the result. All right, so I'll try to do it quick. So the unipolar inductor is a model that was introduced by Goldreich and Lindenbell in the 60s. They tried to explain Jupiter the Jupiter Io system that can emit actually decameter radiation. So the picture is the following: that Io is volcanically very active, and the volcanic eruptions actually launch ionized material in high in the atmosphere of Io. And that this ionized material is then captured by the strong magnetic field of Jupiter, creating a magnetosphere around it and flux tubes that connect the Io to Jupiter. And this establishes this system over there. So the Io's surface is a conducting surface that is moving through Jupiter's magnetic field. And as a result, this induces an electromotive force that will drive currents. And then these currents will be dissipated on Io, Jupiter, and in the flux tubes. And this is what Goldreich and Lindenbell did to predict the decameter radiation from the system. So the setting is the following. The magnetosphere of a magnetized body co-rotates with the body. This is the magnetized star. And this is the part of the magnetosphere. So we have a flux tube that is connected to the companion. And we have, as long as the magnetic body is not locked into co-rotation, then the magnetic field will be sweeping this conducting body. And therefore, there will be an EMF induced, just like is shown here on this figure, that will drive these currents. Now, the question is, why does this magnetized body have to spin out of sync? And here's a movie I created. So here's the star. We're looking down on the equatorial plane. These are supposed to be the magnetic field lines of the dipole that you're looking up from the top. And if you have co-rotation, that is the spin angular frequency of the star is the same as the orbital angular frequency, then the same field lines always cross the star. There's no relative motion between the two, and therefore you cannot induce an electromotive force. Whereas if you have the opposite case, you have difference between the spin angular frequencies, my computer is dying, then you can see that actually the star, the companion, is crossing different field lines as the evolution proceeds. Before it was only on the blue lines, now it's green lines, now it goes to the red lines. So you can actually have this effect. All right, so since I'm running out of time, so this is the basic idea, and you can actually go some through some order of magnitude estimates and find directly the power that is dissipated onto the system. And so what we did recently was to test the idea by McWilliams 11. They applied essentially the unipolar inductor model on BHNS binaries, where the neutron star here is the magnetic object and the black hole is the conducting body. And in the membrane paradigm of the black hole is a sphere of radius equal to the Schwarzschild radius and a resistance equal to the 4 pi over C. And if you plug that into the equations, divide the current that you have, I squared times the resistance, we will give you the dissipated energy, and it has this scaling here as it's shown for magnetic dipole fields. And you have this strong dependence on the separation because as the binary in spirals, the magnetic field that essentially threads and sweeps the horizon becomes stronger and stronger and stronger due to the 1 over a cubed fall off of the magnetic field. So similar applications, of course, have been done in the past. There's applications by Jiankin and Lin in 98 for the use the unipolar inductor for planets around white dwarfs. Wu et al, they use the unipolar inductor in compact white dwarf binaries. Then Palenzuela, Lehner et al, they're in the pioneering work. They did these dual jets from binary black holes where you have two black holes and essentially they're orbiting each other in a magnetic field. And you can induce electromotive forces on each of the black holes and power signals. Then Pirro used the unipolar inductor in binary neutron stars. And more recently, Luis and Carlos, they essentially confirmed the unipolar inductor in neutron star binaries. And they also talked about a novel effect for magnetospheric interactions between two companions that are strongly magnetized, both of them. So what we did was to perform simulations of black hole neutron stars to check the viability of this mechanism. We evolved, instead of the electric field and the magnetic field, the pointing vector and the magnetic field, and forcing the frozen in condition in the interior of the neutron star, providing essentially a boundary condition for the exterior force free evolution. And we used the formulation, the ideal MHD formulation of the force free regime. Ideal MHD essentially is the divergence of the total stress energy tensor equals zero, but force free means that the matter part doesn't matter, essentially. And there's a beautiful formulation that McKinney derived in 2006 that essentially writes the force-free equations in a conservation as conservation laws, and then you can incorporate these equations in an ideal MHD code. If you have an ideal MHD code, it's very straightforward to code this formulation. For initial data, we used, for the space-time and the fluid quasi-equilibrium, black hole neutron star satisfying the conformal thin sandwich equations. This gives us a helical killing vector that allows us, instead of being in the co-rotating frame of the binary, to go off the co-rotating frame of the binary, do simply a rotation in the center of mass frame of the binary for the fluid and the spacetime. For the magnetic field, we used a current loop. For the velocity, the component parallel to the B field is zero. The perpendicular component falls as 1 over r squared from the value it has of the surface of the neutron star. And the electric field is calculated based on the ideal MHD condition. So the initial data look like this. This is the red is the neutron star. Black is the black hole. These are the magnetic field lines, the dipole feature that you get. The white lines distinguish lines that thread the horizon, essentially. That's the only difference between the white and the yellow lines. So what we find is that we evolved three cases. One had spin minus 0.5. Spin for the black hole 0 and spin for the black hole 0.75. The mass ratio was 3 in all these cases and the separation fixed to be about 6.6 times the radius of the neutron star. And what we find is that after an initial transient phase due to our choice of non-stationary initial data, the configurations settle into a quasi-stationary configuration, essentially magnetic field geometry. This is for the 0 spin case. This is for the 0.75 case. And the spinning cases, we actually see some partial magnetic winding due to the frame dragging of the black holes. We calculated the outgoing pointing luminosity, and this is in units of ergs per second, but scale with the magnitude of the B field at the pole of the neutron star to be 10 to the 13 Gauss. So that's just a random value we chose. and the results scale with B squared, essentially the luminosity. So we find luminosities of order 5 × 10⁻42 ergs per second at these adopted separations that we chose. And so we basically confirmed that the unipolar induction formula that McWilliams and Levin suggested is in good agreement with our results. No, because we didn't have initial data at multiple separations, that's why. But that's something Carlos and I have actually already talked about, and it'd be good to check. So to summarize, white dwarf neutrinos exist, and they're promising sources for gravitational waves and electromagnetic signals. Current calculations seem to suggest that there's no prone black hole formation from these systems. And nuclear reactions may become very important at the level that if you get yields of you yield amounts of nickel 56 that can shine and possibly explain subluminous type 1a supernovae. And the unipolar induction formula mechanism is a viable mechanism for extracting energy from inspiraling black hole neutron star systems. And the EM output could power such systems and lead to observable EM signatures. One of the things that perhaps I should say here is that in their paper, McWilliams and Levin essentially suggested that if just a fraction of this dissipated energy creates a hotspot on the neutron star, then you may actually get observable X-rays and gamma rays from that could be detected by BAT and SWIFT, for example. So this is where I'll stop.
Assume that that's a boundary condition for some fictitious larger object that you stick there.
Yes.
And then you can do the full problem.
Yeah, so you revealed our secret. So one of the things we're thinking about doing, since this is a very nearly Newtonian, it's a Newtonian system, strictly speaking. You need GR only to assess whether the neutron star is going to collapse or not, nothing. There's no reason why you should choose GR and do all these very expensive simulations. So one of the things that we've thought about doing is to do a Newtonian simulation. In fact, do the Newtonian simulation, even including the nuclear reactions, because that can be totally doable. I've downloaded the flash code, and I've actually played with all these things. And so the idea is to perform the simulation at stages, do the in spiral using a point mass for the neutron star instead of an actual neutron star over there, get something realistic out of it, and then take this data, map them from time to time onto a general relativistic code, and see whether that can lead to a neutron star collapse or not. But in the end, to be honest, the first step that I would do would be to include the nuclear reactions from the beginning. And if indeed there's a detonation and something takes place and things are blown apart and the total mass in the remnant is not even close to the maximum mass that can be supported, then we're done. It's a done deal. But you're right. There are smarter ways of dealing with the problem. Mm-hmm.
That's not true. It's not true if you look carefully, because the transition from deflagration to detonation is still very poorly understood.
Yes.
So how do people understand that in the economy? How did Metzger and company properly report today?
Well, they do parametric studies. They don't do it self-consistently. However, given that my advisor is Alexei Koklov, who is a type 1a supernova explosion expert, and he was one of the pioneers of this deflagration to detonation techniques. So I have to say that there is research that is done in terrestrial combustion. And he's actually discovered recently, like a few months ago, the first self-consistent simulation that has a transition, because this deflagration, the detonation, occurs even in terrestrial combustion. It doesn't have to do with the universe or the stars or white dwarfs. And so he's done the first self-consistent simulation that transitions from deflagration to detonation using essentially all the physics and all, including all the chemistry that is involved. And I think it's going to be a good step for trying to understand what's happening in white dwarfs later on. But I think there's exciting science coming out soon. But yeah, all these other stuff are still at a theoretical level of parameterizing quantities. That's right. Yep.
I guess it's a Newtonian business. I mean, there is something that the problem would be that you don't really know how much of the stuff that falls into the your Newtonian neutrinos that actually comes back out.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be. Yeah. There would be no feedback. So it would be just it would be just a first order thing you can do in order to try to see whether things come and happen.
So I mean, so there are these different modes of accretion, and like for, you know, that for the black hole, that there's one, if you have a thin geometric within this, then everything goes in, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you have a thick disk, then which fraction of what goes in can come out?
Well, I would think that part of the disks are going to be thin and part of the disks are going to be thick in this case. So, but we'll see. I mean, that's right.